Well, that do ya. I could see your little blinker going. Well, I was working down Whitlock to see after. They were making in Nissen huts, bound for Iceland. All asbestos Nissen huts. Just the outsides, not the cargoes and stuff. We made the ends. And then I was waiting for me calling up papers, really, so to get me hand in, I joined Dalesville Home Guard. Thought, well, I can learn how to use a rifle and do a little squad drill before I get called up. And eventually me papers come. This I got to give for a medical. What branch of the armed forces did I want to go in? And my father was in the Navy in the First World War, and I had an old uncle. He was in the Navy also in the First World War. He'd actually joined up before 1914. He was out in Malta in 1910 and 1912. Then he went to Australia and that sort of thing. So I put in to go in the Navy. Eventually had me papers come to go for a medical to Ipswich. I think it was one Saturday I had to go. Got the Eldon with a bloke from Little Eldon being on the station. He was going as well, a bloke named Johnny Hart. We got the house to station. There was another one I knew, Dick Pryke. He was Eddie's girlfriend. He was going to Ipswich for a medical. So we all three went, found our way to the medical centre, and we all passed A1. And when we finished, I ushered us into a room, and a chief petty officer come in and took a few more particulars from us. And then a Royal Marine Sergeant come in, I always remember it. He said, do any of you here play a musical instrument? And I thought, well, I played the piano because I had piano lessons. I thought, I'm going to keep quiet. My father said, don't volunteer for anything, boy. So I kept quiet. Come on, he said. Surely, I mean, there must have been 30 or 40 of us. Surely one of you can play a musical instrument. Up went Johnny Hart's hand from North End. Ah, well done, sir, he said. What instrument do you play? Johnny said, the mouth organ. He said, I don't think a Royal Marines band, he said, got any vacancies for mouth organ players. We all, the rest of us, all laughed like hell. Anyhow, after that, we had to wait about 6 weeks before we got a calling up papers. And I had to report, my papers come. I got a report to HMS Glendower at Pwllheli, North Wales. The hell is Pwllheli, North Wales? Got the map out, found it. Looked miles away. Well, it was miles away. Got to be there on May the 19th, 1942. Well, I went down to the Eldon station, saw station master, and he said he worked it out. He said, there's no way you can get to North Wales in one day from Eldon. He said, your first train we have in is 8 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't possibly get to London, cross London to Paddington, and then catch a train to Pwllheli. So I've got an aunt and uncle live in London. My mother got in touch with them, and they said, yeah, you can spend the night with us here. And they lived in Crofton Park near Lewisham, South East London. So I caught an afternoon train from Eldon the day before, made my way across London to their place. And then old Uncle George drove me to Paddington Station the next morning. There was about, I suppose, 20 or 30 young fellas on the platform. We were all going to Pwllheli. And I remember we had to change at a place called Rhiwabon. That's the first time I'd ever seen a mountain. And I've looked times on the map for Rhiwabon. I could never find it, what county that was in or where, anyhow. We eventually got to a little station, they called it Penny Jane Holt. We had to get off there. And there was a petty officer there to meet us. Nice old boy he was. He'd been in the First World War and they'd called him up sort of as a reservist. He said, now I know you blokes have had a long journey. He said, but try and fall in threes and try and look a bit smart as we march to the camp. He said, I'll show you to you. We was all in up some Butler's Holiday Camp. We didn't realise that. Had a great Butler's Holiday Camp. You're going in so many in a chalet each. He said, now you can have a wash and brush up. And he said, you come and have your supper in the mess tent. So we, half a dozen went in one hut, half a dozen in another, Charlie, and so on. We found a toilet block and had a wash and brush up, and then we went and had, I don't know what we had to eat, but anyhow, we had something hot. And then we went to bed, we was all knocked up. And the next morning, they split us up in gangs of about 30 in a class with a chief petty officer, an old retired boy. We had an old Cornish chief petty officer look after, a Cornishman. And he done squad drill to start with, and then they kitted you out with your uniform, one thing and another. And you had to go another day in front of a doctor and have vaccinations. Another day in front of a dentist, they would look at your teeth. One old boy said, if you ain't going to stop your teeth, he said, if you have anything wrong with your teeth? I said, I don't think so. He said, cool. He said, oh, yeah, bloody broke. He said, he stopped one of mine, he hit a nerve. He said, Christ, he said, I thought it was going to kill me. He said, I know what I should do in future. I said, what? He said, I shall holler before he get to deep. So when he looked in mine, he said, you want one there won't stop. And he said, I'll do it straight away. So I sat in the chair and he's adrenaline one. I thought, I reckon he's gone far enough. All of a sudden I give a yell and jumped. Oh, he said, I thought I'd gone far enough. And he stopped it. And I had that for years after that. Anyhow, we used to parade every morning at 9 o'clock in front of the captain. I mean, there was about 7,000 of them there. Hell of a place. And the Royal Marine Band would be there. I start off with the national anthem, and then I'd have a hymn of some description, and then the captain would read, I don't know, I reckon that was the collect for the week, or the collect for the day, and then a few prayers, and then we would sing a couple of verses of Jerusalem, come to the band accompanying us, and then we'd have the first, the second, and last verse of Eternal Father, Strong to Save. Every morning. We'd done that for 3 months. And we then had 6 weeks seamanship training. And we had to sit exams at the end of the 6 weeks. And they sent us home for a weekend leave after 6 weeks. Well, up to job even then to get from Pawelli back to Yeldon in a day. We managed it somehow. I think we left Pawelli about 7 o'clock in the morning and then changed at Bangor somewhere and various other places. Anyhow, I got the album a Friday night. And then, so I haven't got back to Pawelli. We then had to wait a few days before we got drafted. We'd all got to be sent to various ports to go in the pool and wait for a ship. And the draft notices went up about the Thursday. So we were all scanning the notice boards to see where we got to be sent. I got my name down with two others, excuse me, to go to Falmouth, right down in Cornwall. Some were going to North, excuse me, some were going to North Shields, some Liverpool, all over the place. So anyhow, we eventually got on a train at Pawelli to go to Falmouth, and we got as far as Plymouth, and we couldn't get to Falmouth that night. So we had to sling our hammers, first time we'd ever slung hammers, because we slept on bunks. We had to sling hammers in the naval depot at Plymouth, I think that was called HMS Drake, and then catch the next train, early train in the morning to Falmouth, where we were met at the station. Taken to a hotel along the seafront that the Navy commandeered. And there was about 30 sailors in there, all waiting for ships. And some of them had been there 3 weeks to a month. So we thought, us three, we thought, well, we can't get a ship yet. Anyway, we joined the joining routine, and we got talking to the other folks what was waiting for a ship when we had lunchtime. And apparently there were two big troop ships in port. They were Dutch liners, but they'd been converted to troop ships. One was called a New Zealand and one was called a New Holland. And everybody near, well, appeared to us that nearly everybody had volunteered to go on these troop ships. And they said, you want to put your name down to go on them? They want at least 30 gunners on there. So I thought, and then my father told me not to volunteer for anything. So I said, I'm not volunteering. And a couple of three more, I said, we're not. Well, we'd only been there about a week. We got sent for to the regulating office, and the ferry officer said, I've got a ship for you three. When he said, you've got to get your kit ready this afternoon at 4 o'clock outside the front main door, and you'll be taken to your ship. We said, what is it? He said, I can't tell you that. And he said, you shouldn't ask. Now, we was all ready at 4 o'clock. They picked us up. There was a Londoner who was driving this little pickup truck. And he took us down. We went by the troop ships. And we finally pulled up on the quay, and a mast was sticking over the top. And we looked down, and there was this little 300-ton coaster. There were three gunners on there waiting to come to be taken off. And we three ready to take their place. They slung their kit bags up, and we slung ours down. And when they come up, we said, what's she like? They said, she's a bugger. She rolls like hell, they said. You'll be all right. And the lorry driver, this London, he said, you poor bastards, he said. Anyway, we got them. And the cook come steward was an old fella. An old boy named Jim. He welcomed us, he showed us our cabin. He had a word with us and one thing and another. And when we unpacked our thing, we had a little wardrobe each. We each chose which bunk we was going to sleep on. There was a bloke named Smith. He was senior rating to us other two. So we had the first choice. He had the bunk on his own. Us other two had one top of the bottom. Bacon from Portland wanted to go up the one on top, and I said, oh, well, I'll have the one at the bottom. Well, Jim said, you won't get the tea, he said, because the others have had your tea. Well, we were getting hungry about 6 o'clock. I said, I'm starving. And Smithy said, so am I. He came from Workington, this Smith. I said, let's go ashore and get some fish and chips. He said, all right. So Baker, the other gunner from Portland, he said, I'm not coming. Bring me some back. And me and Smithy went to the dock gates, and we saw the policeman on the dock gates, and we said, we've just joined the Empire Lily, it was called. We said, we're just going ashore for some fish and chips. He said, oh, all right. We said, I haven't got a dock pass. He said, don't matter. There we went, and we had some fish and chips and stood outside the fish shop and had them. Then we went and had a couple of pints of beer and dipped back to the fish shop to get bake or something. And we got back on board, and we were sailing the next morning. And the next morning, at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, we let go and we sailed out into the English Channel. Of course, we were keen as mustard. We got the guns all manned. We were there ready. We were ready. We'd have got anybody to take us. We were right on the ball. But apparently, we were only going 30 miles along the coast to a little Cornish port called Par. And we got to Par before lunch, well, about 12 o'clock time, tied up in Par, and that was all, the quay was all covered with white dust, and we found that up was China clay dust. We were going to load up on the Monday with 300 tonne of China clay. And in the afternoon, I went ashore to post a letter, and I saw that they'd got a harvest festival in the village church on the Sunday, so I came back and I said, it's a nice little pub outside the church, outside the dock gates. I said, and the church got a harvest festival on Sunday. I said, I'm going to harvest festival. So they said, well, you go. We'll see you in the pub at lunchtime afterwards. I went to church, and I come out, and I went in the pub, and there were the other two. Mate came in here about 10 minutes afterwards. And when we came back on board ship, the captain called us. He said, I want you three just a minute. He said, look, you can't all go ashore at once. One of you must keep aboard at all times. He said, I'm not being responsible for the naval guns or your ammunition. So you make it amongst yourselves who's going to stay aboard. But there must be one here at all times. So we said, all right, well, we didn't know. So that night I said, I'm going for a drink. No, we didn't. We didn't go ashore that night. The Sunday I went to Harvest Festival and met them in the pub. And we come back and had our dinner, met one in the pub. And at night time I said, I'm going for a pint. Smithy said he ain't got the money. Baker didn't want to come. And I said, look, I've got 10 bob. I said, that'll be enough, because I think beer was about eightpence a pint then, I think, old money. Smithy said, look, I've got a lad to write, I'll join you there. So I went in the bar in all on my own. It was fairly full up, about 8 o'clock at night, and I had a pint and gave this barmaid a 10 bob note. Whether she took a fancy to me, I don't know, but she gave me change for a pound. And I thought, what have I got to do? I thought, this pound is going to do us more good than change for 10 bob. So I watched pints and I waited till I stuck a 10 bob in my sock, put the change in my pocket. Smithy came in and I said, yeah, go and get yourself a pint. And I noticed somebody changed a pound out. I thought, well, she won't know who, what happened then. So when we sat down quiet, I said, we can drink up, Smithy. I said, I'm 10 bob better off than I was when I come in. About 42 years later, I went back there, went in the same pub. And I said to the landlord, after I'd ordered our drink, I owe this pub 50 pence. I said, 42 years ago, I said to the landlady or the barmaid, give me 10 shillings too much. I said, and I've been on my conscience ever since, that's the 50 pence. He said, well, there's 3 charity tins, take a pick. So I shoved it in one. And he said, what about the interest? I said, I've got news, mate, I never invested it. Anyhow, we came back to Falmouth to wait for a convoy after we'd loaded up. And we sailed out of Falmouth on a Friday afternoon or Friday evening to join the convoy and everything. Gale blowing outside. And we went round Land's End that night and, call hell, was it rough. We were all seasick. I never had felt so bad. We're going up the west coast and the Sunday morning we got off the mouth of Bristol Channel and the skipper felt so sorry for us. He left the convoy and he pulled into the shelter of Lundy Island, dropped anchor, and he sent word down. He said, well, most of the crew were all seasick as well. He said, we're going to have 24 hours here till the storm blow itself out. He said, and we'll then carry on our own. He said, we'll have to leave the convoy altogether. We said, tell those gunners, he told us to it. He said, tell those gunners to have dry toast. Even if they only keep it down 5 minutes, that'll do them good. We had a few bits of dry toast. And old Jim, the cook, he collared me. He said, I can tell, he said, you're a cut above the other two. He said, you'll be able to give me a hand if I want it, won't you? Of course, I fell for that. I said, yeah, of course I will, Jim. And I found out what he meant, give him a hand, was to peel about a bucket full of potatoes nearly every morning. Anyway, we left Lundy the Monday or the Tuesday and went up the west coast all on our own. The convoy had long gone. And we took our china clay to Preston, up the river, sailed by Black Bull Tower, up the River Ribble, tied up in Preston and then loaded up with coal, came back to Falmouth or Truro, and that was more or less the trip we'd done. We were laying an anchor one night at Melford Haven. One Sunday night, all nice and quiet, and I went up on deck to get a bit of fresh air before we turned in. And leaning over the rail, listening, there weren't many sounds going about. Now and again, you'd hear an old seagull cry. And I heard a knock on the skipper's door, because the captain's cabin door was sort of deck level. And I heard a knock, and I heard a old man, he was a Scotchman. And the chief mate was a Scotchman. They'd been fishermen from Bucky. They went to school together, so they'd been mates all their lives, sort of thing. I heard him say, come in, and old Jim, the steward, he said, I heard him say, got your cocoa, sir? Oh, thank you, Jim, put it down there. Anything else you want, sir? He said, no, thank you, Jim. Good night, sir, good night, Jim. I thought, oh, Jim said he took the old man a mug of cocoa every night, about nine. And that went several minutes. And I had the old cabin door open, not the deck. And I had him put the hook on the door. I thought, the old man's coming out there. And then the hook went on. And then he said he got the toilet to unload himself, to relieve himself. He done it out through the door on the deck. I thought, daddy, over you. Anyhow, I waited till he finished and shut the door, and I went down below to the cabin. The other two lay there reading. I said, you know that dark stain across the deck? And I said, yeah. I said, old man piddled out there every night. That's where that dark stain come from. Well, I never, they said. Well, a few days later, a few weeks later, we was up in Silloth in Cumberland. And we went ashore to have a pint lunchtime. And like every village or every town, there was an old scrap heap where old bicycles and old bed sheets were all chucked. Somebody would come along, I think, and clear them and melt them all down for munitions. And there, halfway up his heap, was a white enamel Charles potty. I looked at that, I said, we ought to take that back. So I clambered up the heap and I got it, put it down the bottom of the heap. And I said, we'll hide it and we'll come tonight and pick it up and bring it home in the dark. Take it on board in the dark. That was what I'd done. We hid it down below. We went ashore that night and had another couple of pints and retrieved this pot from the heap, took it and smuggled it on board and hid it in our cabin. Then we got to wait for the opportunity. It weren't many days we was at anchor again. And I said, are we going to put our operation into process tonight? They said, if you like. Then all three of us went up in deck, up on deck just before nine. And I said, who's going to put the pot in the place? They said, you're the main one who thought about it. You put it there. So I said, oh, all right then. So in our stocking feet, we stood on the deck. Had to knock on the door. Your cocoa, sir. Thank you, Jim. Anything else? No, thank you, Jim. Good night, sir. Good night, Jim. So I thought, now's the chance to go forward, quietly put it down what I thought was going to be the line of fire, so to speak. And we had the old man opening the door a few minutes later. And then we heard him start. He started and he stopped. He started again. And he stopped again. I mean, I don't suppose any of you have ever peddled in an enamel pot on a steel deck in the stillness of the night, but it made quite an eerie sound. He put the light on in his cabin, he flung the door open, he came out and he could see this pot. We realised we were standing back half watching him in the dark. We realised that in his young days he'd been a footballer, because he sent his left foot into that pot. It cleared the rail out into the sea, contents and all. When he shut the door, we scurried back to our cabin, got on our bunks, pulled the blankets overhead and made out we were asleep. But we kept listening for his footsteps and they never came. And so I thought, he's all right, he won't come down now. And he never did say a word about him, never did, till we had Christmas. And we decided, well, we couldn't get home for Christmas. We was only going to be 2 days up the ship canal. Manchester. And Baker had got an aunt in Oldham. He went home for Christmas Day. Us other two, we stayed on board with a second engineer. He'd got to go to Scotland. He didn't bother. He said, I'll get a nice bit of pork and I'll cook your lads Christmas lunch. You go and have a couple of pints. Come back at 2 o'clock or 2:30. He said, we'll have a nice bit of roast pork. So we did. Crackling and all, very lovely. So then, when we got the new year, we got down to Falmouth or Truro, and I said, I don't know, I've been 4 months now on board here. I said, I think I'm going to put in for leave. And Smithy and the other two, they said, yeah, I think we will and well. So we went to Falmouth and we went to the naval officer and said we'd like leave. And they said, well, you've got to have a letter from your skipper recommending you for leave. Petty officer said, so where he said, will it be any trouble to get it? I said, no, I don't think so. And we went back on bus to Truro, and they said, they said, you go and see him, Ruggles, you're better at it than what we are. So I knocked his cabin door and Come in here, hello, Ruggles, what can I do for you? I said, we decided, sir, I said, we'd been 4 months without any leave. We'd like to have a week's leave. If you've no objection, he said, no, not at all. I said, well, apparently we've got to have a letter from you recommending that we have leave. He said, oh, it won't be any trouble. He said, come back in a couple of hours' time and I'll have the letter for you. I said, oh, I said, thank you very much. So I went back to our cabin. They said, I bet he ain't going to write one. I said, he is. I said, I bet he write us a good reference. I said, he'll be only too pleased to get rid of us three. So eventually I went and tapped his cabin door. Here you are, Ruggles. He said, here's your letter. And thank you, sir. I said, we'll take it to Falmouth tomorrow morning. And we went through the next morning, gave this letter to the petty officer, and he said, hang on, I'll just take it in to the commander. He came back and he said, the commander want to see you three. I thought, oh God, I wonder what he's wrote in that letter. So we all was ushered into the commander's office to their attention. He said, well, lads, he said, I've had some lovely references from different skippers of ships. He said, but none to beat this one. He's wrote you a perfect reference, he said. And for that, he said, I'm going to give you an extra 3 days' leave. He said, you have 10 days instead of a week. We said, thank you, sir. So he said, what do you want to do when you come back? So Smith, he'd already been on a Russian convoy. He said, he thought he'd like to go deep sea. So Baker, me, never made much answer. So I said, I think we'd all like to keep together if we could. I said, I wouldn't mind another spell on a coaster. Baker said, no, he wouldn't either. And he said, well, I'll see what I can do. Go and enjoy your leave. We said, thank you, sir. And when we got back from leave, that was when I saw Herr Smithy in the railway station at Plymouth. I got as far as Plymouth that night, and the porter said, well, we had to go further. He said, you'll have to go and sleep in the waiting room. So I made my way down to where the little blue light's shooting. Got my head down here now. Smithy was one, he could always break wind. I used to say he can nearly play God Save the King with his backside. And then only just laid down and somebody broke wind the other end in the dark. And I said, is that you, Smithy? He said, yes, yeah, that you, Rose. I recognised the tone. Anyhow, we got back to Falmouth and got in the pool waiting again for a ship. 2 days. Come on, I want to see you. We were in front of the commander. He said, did you have a nice leave, you three? We said, yes, sir, thank you. He said, I've got a ship for you. He said, sorry, I'm so quick. He said, that's a little Dutch coaster, he said, up at Truro. He said, the three gunners on there have misbehaved. He said, they've spent the night in prison, and we've got to take them off. He said, now you three, he said, with your reference, he said, I want you to show that Dutch skipper that not all Englishmen are like the other three. He said that Dutch skipper sailed his coaster over to England on his own when Holland got invaded. He said, with his chief mate, we fixed him up with a crew, we fixed him up with guns. He said, you three go and be ambassadors. We said, all right, sir. we got on the line, we went up to Truro and we joined it, and that was about the same size ship. And but a lovely little coaster, all clean as a new pin. The Dutchman, he could speak broken English after a fashion. The chief mate, he couldn't. He'd got a couple of ferrets on board. He'd brought his ferrets with him, chief mate, eh? And we hadn't been on there long, and he got me, so I was feeding these ferrets. What the hell he chose me for? And then he had to go away and sit for a skipper's certificate. He said, Ruggles, in his Holland, he said, you will look after my ferrets, won't you? I said, yeah, I'll look after them. So I used to look after his ferrets till we left the ship. We eventually got, we took some coal to Ireland, to Neary. And going up the river to Neary, the pilot, the skipper, the Dutch skipper asked the pilot, did he know if anybody wanted a job, deckhand? Oh, sir, he said, I know the very man. He said, the very man, he said, he's quiet, he said, young, strong, doesn't drink. He said, all his money home to his dear old mother, he said, single, he said, hard working. He said, send him along and I'll have a look at him. So young Paddy, as we called him, came along. And he joined us. We left Neary and went round the top side of the mountains of Mourne, a little port called Dundrum. Got to Dundrum and we loaded up 300 tonne of potatoes to bring back. We only just got out in Dundrum Bay and a ship broke down. We laid an anchor a week trying to get it to go, and eventually the engineers got the engines going on two cylinders. It took us nearly a week to come across the Irish Sea. We lived on potatoes for about 10 days. And when we come to Cardiff. And we tied up in Cardiff. I mean, the crew had got a fortnight's money to have. So had we. But this little Irishman, this young Irishman, drew his money and he went and had a shower and put his best suit on. He was going to have a look good at the pictures, he said. 11 o'clock at night, he come back drunk as a lord. He couldn't get on board. We had to help him on board. And the next morning, we undressed him, put him in his bunk. We said, that pilot said you didn't drink or smoke. He said, that was my uncle. He said he wanted to get rid of me. He said he made out. He said, I drink. Now, Paddy could drink like a horse, he could. So we had several weeks on there, and you had to report your ship in Cardiff. In front of a commander in the base. You just walk in and he'd say, what ship? And you tell him, and he'd look at him, how long are you going to be here? Or when are you going to sail? And we used to take it in turns to go, because we didn't want to get recognised if we could help it. Finally, after about 5 weeks, he said, how long have you been in here once, sir? I said, I think about a fortnight, sir. It seems longer than a fortnight to me, he said. I was about 5 weeks. If you're not soon going to sail, he said, we'll have to take you off there. Can't have you pitting about in there. Well, in Cardiff Docks, they had a big dome-shaped building, which had trained gunners in there. They had a machine gunner sitting on the floor with a high-pressure hose go to it, high-pressure air block go through, that you get behind there, pull the trigger, that would sound as though that was a machine gun. And then they flash a film on the roof of an enemy aircraft attacking you. You've got to recognise the aircraft, you've got to guess, and you've got your crosswires on the side, and in front of the aircraft would come a yellow dot, and you couldn't see it because there was a yellow piece of glass in your eyepiece. And I watched several of them come across. I thought, you've got to look for that yellow dot if you can find it. Anyhow, when it was my turn, I thought, look about 2 foot in front of the plane and wait till the spot appear. Sure enough, I could see this spot. So I got my cross wires right on this spot, right the way across the roof. Then I got out of sight. So I sat down and the petty officer said, what's your name? I said, Ruggles. And when that all had to go, he said, Ruggles, I said, have another go. And up I got again, and I thought, look for this yellow dot again. Sure enough, I could see it, and got me cross wired right above. He said, what were you in Civvy Streets? I said, I'm a carpenter. Countryman, he obviously a countryman, I said, yeah. He said, can you come down here tomorrow? So I said, yeah. I went down the next day, called me up again. I could see the dot again, over I went. And he said, oh, all right. What ship are you on? I told him, the Union. I went about a fortnight and a dispatch rider come on board one morning. Ruggles, I said, yeah. He said, you got a report at the dome, he said, this morning at 10 o'clock sharp. Have your best suit on, all your best clothes on. I said, why, what's on? He said, Commander Chief of Western Approach is paying a visit to the port and he wants to see the dome. I've had orders that you've got to be there. So I went at 9:55 and got in, and this petty officer says, oh, Ruggles, I want you. There was about 20 of them there to have a go. He said, you get in amongst the others, he said, and he briefed all the others. He said, when the Commander in Chief comes in, he said, I should call you all to attention. He said, you smartly stand up to attention. He said, and he'll probably say, carry on, petty officer. he said, and I should say, right, next one up, and Ruggles, I want you to come up. Get behind that gun. I said, all right, sir. I thought, my God, I hope I can see that yellow dot. Eventually, the door out, right, attention, we all jumped to attention, and in come this bloke, full of gold braid and brass buttons, one thing or another. And they took us, he took a salute off the petty officer, and he said, carry on, petty officer. I said, right, oh, next one up, please. So up, I jumped smartly, got behind, got the harness on, got behind his machine gun. And I started rolling this, and his plane come, and sure enough, I could see the dot, right on the dot, right away over. Right away, and I got out of sight. Right out, thank you very much. And he said, well done, old commander, well done, petty officer. He said, you're training them well. Goodbye and good night. Take us out. And off we went. He said, right out, we can all relax now. I was the only one to ever go. The others, was, I think, nearly weighing themselves. I think they'd got a big call up. We hadn't been on there long. I've been there about a week after that. They come down and they said, we got a ship for you. I was sent on a 1,000-tonner called the Empire Shoal. Smithy went on a Dutch, on a Polish ship. And I don't know where Baker went, but about 6 months later, I had a letter from Smithy. He was in Alexandria. He'd been torpedoed in the Mediterranean. And he'd lost everything. And that's the only letter I ever did have. I never did hear any more. I should have really, I suppose, got in touch with his family at Workington, but I never did. Baker I did. Years later, I happened to go to Portland, and I thought, oh, I'm in Portland now. I know where Baker lived. I found his road, and I found a number. I knew he lived in number 4, Spring Gardens, and I put a note through the door, who I was, and about a fortnight later, I had a letter from London. His mother still lived there, but he'd married. Lived in London, and he wrote me a letter from London to say, one of these times I'll come down in Essex to see you, but I never have seen him anymore. Anyhow, I had 4 months on this Empire Shoal. It was a nice ship. We used to go from Silloth in Cumberland to Drogheda in County Louth in Irish Free State. Take coal to a cement factory. 12 hours, you could leave Silloth at high tide and catch the high tide in Drogheda. And it was getting summertime. Dolly was working up London at Cossus, and I knew she was having a week's holiday or a fortnight's holiday in August, and I was due for leave. We came back to Port Talbot in South Wales. So I went and saw the skipper. I said, I think I'll put in for leave now. He was a North Walian. Nobody really liked him, but I got all right with him. He said, you're not going to leave me, are you, Dick? And I said, yeah, I'm on over. I said, my girlfriend having a fortnight's holiday. I said, I haven't had a leave for a long time. I said, I'll probably get a fortnight as well. He said, well, why don't you leave your kit aboard? He said, come back and join us. I said, well, I would if they let me. So I went to the naval office and told them I wanted to leave. I said, the master of the boat want me back again. And they said, well, you'll have to take your kit off. And if he comes back in here when you come back, then you can join it. If not, you'll have to get a fresh ship. So I came home for a fortnight's leave and only been home 3 days. Had a telegram from him. They were sailing from Port Talbot to Southampton. They'd got to have another gunner to go through the English Channel. Was I coming back or not? So I telegrammed them back, no. They got another gunner then. So I never saw any of them anymore until nearly the end of the war. I happened to be on a Trinity House boat at Yarmouth, and one day the Empire Shoal went sailing by Yarmouth, by Scroby Sands. Oh, there's my old ship going down to London. So once I got back to Port Talbot, we got sent in private digs in houses. Different ladies used to put us up. Knock on the door one night, 6 o'clock, Ruggles. I said, yeah. And the naval bloke stood there, petty officer stood there. He said, got a ship for you. Then when? He said, now. Now? What, 6 o'clock at night? He said, yeah, dark. Get your kit. He said, we'll pick you up in an hour. So I said, all right. So I got all my kit ready. Picked me up in an hour, said, where are we off to? He said, Swansea. To join the ship. Got to Swansea about 7 or 8 on a 10,000 ton tanker. And no sooner got aboard and they let go and we was at sea. Oh, that's quick. There was about 6 gunners on there, 6 or 7 gunners on there. Great big 10,000 ton tanker. They were going to make their way around to Canvey Island to bunker up. They load up with oil, to bunker up with oil before going to America. That's what the rumour was. And we went right up to Scotland, right through the Pentland Firth, and down the east coast to Canvey Island. Tied up in Canvey Island one Sunday morning, and the skipper said, if anybody want to go ashore for 24 hours, they can. So I thought, well, I can go up to London for the day. How far was it up to London? There was a couple of Londoners on there. So I thought I'd take Dolly's old uncle a couple of 100 woodbines and take her on some sugar that we'd saved. So I got my case all ready, ready for the gangway to go ashore, and the custom stood on the quay. And one of these Londoners, one of the crew, shouted to the customs bloke, how many cigarettes can I take ashore? He said, how long are you going for? He said, 24 hours. Oh, you can only take 50, he said. Oh dear, he said, I've got a couple of 100 now. He said, you only take 50. I stood there, I thought, what a fool, I thought. Well, did he keep quiet? I've got 200 in my case. I thought, oh well, I'm going to chance it. I thought, I would make out I'm a bit deaf. Anyhow, the companionway went ashore. We passed one another on the companionway and they never said a word. Got in the train and this deckhand, I said, I've got a swore about you asking that custom bloke. I said, I've got 200 fags in my case. He said, so have I. I said, I thought you were going to change them. He said, I only made out that. He said, if I hadn't said anything, I'd have searched us. He said, I never changed them. He said, I just made out I was going to. And we got back on the Monday and we sailed back again and laid anchor up in Scotland in a big lock called Loch Ewe, EWE. And I spent... I suppose there was about 50 ships waiting in that block, big lock. Didn't have to wait for tide or anything. It was deep enough to take everything. And eventually we set sail and we joined other ships in the Atlantic. And we finally set sail for New York. 90-ship convoy. 10 in long line and 9 deep. 45 tankers, all empty, all in the middle of the convoy. We went right up Iceland and Greenland. You can see the icy mountains of Greenland. I never had bits of cold. The cold burnt your cheeks. There was icebergs. Anyhow, we finally got to America coast, Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia. Some went into Halifax. The rest of us went down south. Some went into New York or some. I think some carried on to an oil port in Texas, Galveston. I think some went down to Galveston. We had a fortnight in New York. One or two repairs was carried out. We had one of the gunners he'd been an officer in the Scots Regiment. Gordon Highlanders he'd been in, but he got wounded in the knee at one of the raids, I think a Dieppe raid. They wanted to invalid him out of the army. And now he volunteered for the Maritime Regiment because they asked for volunteers from the Royal Artillery to join what they called a Maritime Regiment. So we had soldiers on as gunners with us as well. And his name was Fife. And Fife, he got tons of money. And because he'd been an officer in an Highland Regiment, he could wear his kilt whenever he went ashore. I've held his kilt times when he twisted in it and buckled it. He never did wear a stitch underneath it. That was honest true. We'd walk up Broadway and the girls, they couldn't believe his kilt. They used to go and feed around the bottom and Fife, he kept laughing. He went in one shop and he saw some ties in the window he liked. Little square ties, you know, all the way down. He bought 4 dozen of the damn things. Brought them all aboard, give us all one each. I never did know what happened to mine. I reckon somebody pinched it. Anyhow, we loaded up 10,000 ton, and they split the convoy up coming back. 2 45s. Back we went up, ran by Greenland again, and I was foggy for about half the trip home. We finally got to Glasgow, and there went one ship lost going or coming back. They gave us all an extra 3 days leave for that. Came home on 10 days leave, went back to Glasgow, and we got handpicked, several of us. We got to go down to Southampton. We'd all been recommended we should sit for a leading seaman's promotion. Got to go to a place called Southampton, and called HMS Safeguard. It was in a little village. I was in a part of outside Southampton, about 5 or 6 miles, called Totten, right in the New Forest. Great big house, great big sort of country house it had been before the war. And we was all in bedrooms there. It was about, I suppose, 15 of us went from Glasgow and picked a few up. There was a few more came from there. There was about 80 or 90 ratings there in various stages. And you had a month down there on this, what they called a refresher course. And you split up in various parties, you know, a red watch, blue watch and a white watch. One had to do cleaning round there mornings and afternoons. The other ones had to go on lectures and new guns coming out and that sort of thing. And I was on a cleaning party one, hadn't been there many days. I was having to clean the loos out. And I always played the bugle about 10 o'clock in the morning to stand easy. Stand there 10 minutes smoking time. And I heard the bugle go, but I didn't smoke. So I was still in the toilets cleaning them out. And the petty officer looked in. He said, "Didn't you hear the bugle go, Jack?" I said, "Yeah, I heard it." He said, "Stand easy, you know." I said, "I know, but I don't smoke." I said, "I only got this one to finish," I thought. "Oh, damn it, I'll finish it while I'm here." He said, "What's your name?" I said, "Tom Ruggles." He said, "Well, you should have your 10 minutes when you go." I said, "I know, but I don't make much difference to me." And the next morning when we lined up, after we'd watched the flag pull up and they played, you know, national anthem, one thing or another. We got out, and the same petty officer come along with his board. "Hey, we're Seaman Ruggles, yeah, one step forward." So I stepped one step forward. He said, "Report down to petty officer's mess." Hit the double, so off I went down to the petty officer's mess and asked for petty officer so-and-so. I got down there and I said, "I've been sent to ask for you." He said, "Oh yeah, you're the right and chief petty officer going to send down." He said, "You ain't afraid of work." And I had an every little number there. Every morning I had just to go down there and dust round the petty officer's. And they got a piano in there and I dusted it one morning and played a little tune. Went on, poked his head in the door. He said, "You wouldn't like to come down tonight and play for us, would you?" So I said, "Boy, what you got on?" He said, "We got a little get-together." He said, "One of our blokes is leaving. We're giving him a little party." I said, "Yeah, I don't mind." He said, "All right, come at 9 o'clock. I said, "All right." At 9 o'clock, I went, and the beer was a-flowing. Well, some of them were getting free sheets in the wind. I said, got on a piano, and they had a hell of a sing-song. Didn't finish playing till 12 o'clock. So after that, I had a nice, cushy little number there. Finally, I come to the nitty-gritty. "You're going to sit for your leading seaman's badge." I said, "No, I don't want it." "Oh, come on," they said. I said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't want it." And I got a mate, Cunningham. Now, there was an Admiral Cunningham in those days. Cannington was a Londoner, East Ender. He said, "I don't want bleeding leading seaman." He said, "I ain't going to work." Had to go in front of the commander. He said, "No, I don't want to be leading seaman, so I'll keep able seaman if I can." He said, "What, with a name like Cunningham," he said, "and you want to still stop an able seaman?" He said, "We can't all be admirals, sir," he said. He said, "All right, you carry on." I followed him in. He said, "You're going to be the same as Cunningham?" I said, "Yes, sir." "All right, then." So back we went to Glasgow, and I spoke about a time. We got back to Glasgow on New Year's Eve, 1943. And there, we thought there would be jollifications. There weren't a soul about. The place was deserted. We said, "Fancy coming into Scotland on New Year's Eve and nobody." This was about 1 in the morning. There wasn't a sign of no life. And we were sleeping on a ship tied up at Greenock. And we got back to the ship and got in our hammocks and one thing and another, and we'd been there about 2 days. We got a draft to go on. We got to join a troop ship called the Otranto, an Orient liner. We got kitted out with tropical kit. What shirts, white shorts, everything. We're off to India. So we sailed on the Otranto and we went down through the Straits of Gibraltar and through the Med, through the Red Sea and across to India. There was about 9,000 Air Force and Army, and there was about 100 of us naval blokes. We manned the guns going over. We got to go to Bombay. There were 50 Queen Alexandra's Royal Naval nursing sisters on board, and from 4 o'clock till 5 every afternoon, nobody had got to go on the top deck at all. The top deck was for these nurses to have a bit of fresh air and a stroll and chat together. There got to be no rating, no officer at all. Go on that top deck from 4 to 5. Anyway, we finally made our way. Finally got to Bombay and we disembarked there. We went up to a naval establishment called HMS Braganza. The Air Force and the Army blokes all got taken off and went to their various units. These Queen Alexandra's Royal Naval Nursing Sisters joined another ship, bound for Colombo, Lord Louis Mountbatten's Southeast Asia Command headquarters. And 3 days out, 3 days out from Bombay, they were torpedoed and the lot got drowned. The lot died. I mean, they were, honestly, I shook. Still bring tears to my eyes, even now to talk about it. Dreadful it was. The whole naval barracks in Bombay was right shook by this. They think they'd come all that way, and they was off down the last leg of their journey, and they suddenly got torpedoed going down to Colombo. Anyhow, been there a few days. I had a draft to join a ship in Calcutta. We're going to get to Calcutta. So 5 of us went across country by train to Calcutta. 5 days in the train. All out and through the middle of India, where the little old kids would jump on the running board, pat their little empty bellies, we'd give them a few annas, off they'd jump. Please as hell, we got to Calcutta and went through the joining routine. 2 days later, I got a ship, a Greek ship. It was an old coal burner. She was built on the Tyne in 1927. Her plates was nearly an inch thick, about 6 or 8 rivets riveting the plates. And the only snag was there hadn't been anything done to it for years. It was called the Mina El Cambanis, if you've ever heard such a name. Mina, and then a dash, and then an L, and another dash, and Cambanis. All the officers were Greek. There was 5 Chinese firemen. There were 5 Arabs and 5 Indians. We loaded with coal, which we took down to Colombo. And then we loaded up with stores, naffy stores, back to Bombay. And they had a Portuguese East African as a cook, big old fat bloke. They never carved nothing. You had a great big lump of meat on your plate. But he got a little second cook, a little Chinaman. And I can even remember his name, Yen Arku. He was a lovely little fellow, he was. So we got Yenny to show us how to make pancakes. And every night when that old Portuguese bloke had got out the galley, we used to go in and make ourselves about a dozen pancakes. There was about 5 or 6 of us gunners on there. All the officers were Greek. And she was coal fired, she'd go in convoy. We'd catch a convoy up, we'd hold around with the convoy when the Chinese fired. When the Arabs fired, we dropped a little bit behind. And when the Indians were firing, we dropped a long way behind. Then the Chinese would come on again, we'd catch the convoy up, going all the way down to Bay of Bengal and back up the Indian Ocean to Calcutta. And I worked very well on board now. I was passing a bit of blood, so I went to the doctor in Calcutta before we sailed. And he had a look, he said, "You've got piles." "Yeah, no bother," he said, "no trouble." He said, "eat plenty of fruit and get yourself a bottle of liquid paraffin. Take a spoonful every morning." So I did. I got round to a little port called Cochin and went to the doctor there. Same thing happened. Drank some liquid paraffin, ate plenty of fruit. Got up to Bombay and went ashore in Bombay and went to the doctor in Braganza. He had a look there. Yeah, Miles, he said, "eat plenty of fruit." I thought, "well, I'm a bugger." And I was losing weight. I was always 12 stone. And I knew I could see I was getting thinner. We went back down Colombo and I went to the headquarters of Mount Batten's headquarters in Colombo, a doctor there, and the same thing happened. We then went round the end of Colombo and anchored in a big naval base there called a port called Trincomalee. We was anchored there for about 10 days, waiting for a convoy to go up the Bay of Bengal back to Calcutta. And we got no radio in there, up on a shelf. We were having a dinner one day, and I said, "listen, what's happening? Wait a minute." I stood on a stool, and that was D-Day, when we invaded France. I said, "Christ, we've just invaded France." They keep quiet together. We'd done about 7, 5, 6 miles. So I said, "who was in charge of us?" He said, "go and tell the old man." So I went up on the bridge and the Greek master stood there. So I said, "excuse me, sir, have you heard the radio?" He said, "no." I said, we've invaded France." "Have we?" So I said, "yeah." He said, "look, don't take your ear." He said, "go back to that set. I want to report every hour." So I said, "well, go back. I've gone 15 miles. I've gone 20 miles. That was how we went on. Then when we eventually got back to Calcutta, and I still weren't very well, I went in front of the doctor again and he had a look. He said, "that's piles." I said, "you said that 3 months ago. Have I seen you before?" And I said, "yeah." I said, "and I'm losing weight." I said, I reckon I've lost nearly 2 stone. He said, "well, obviously this Greek ship don't suit you." He said, "well, we better take you off and have you under observation." So I got whipped off and got in the naval barracks. They got a naval barracks right down near Calcutta Race Course. So I got in there and nobody took any notice of me till I'd been there about a fortnight. And I was so ill during the night that there was about 3 or 4 in the room I was in. They got right worried. They went and got out of the sick bay at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the sick birth attendant come. He said, "you'll have to come in our little hospital." They wheeled me there on a trolley, shoved me on the bed, and about an hour later the doctor come and he said, "you'll have to go to the British General Hospital. We can't do nothing for you here." And they lugged me in a lorry to the British General Hospital in Calcutta. Went in front of an army officer, army doctor. He took my temperature and felt my pulse. When he know, oh, he said, "you're the first sailor we've had in here. Plenty of Air Force and plenty of Army." He said, "you're the first matlow we've had in here." He said, "you've got dingle fever." He said, "we'll clear that up with some penicillin." He said, "in about 5 days. Of course, the penicillin will put you right on that." He said, "have you got anything else wrong with your hair?" And I nearly said no. And for some reason I said, "yes, as a matter of fact, I have some." I said, "I've been passing blood with emotions this last 3 or 4 months. "Oh," he said, "that'll be dysentery." He said, we'll do that after we cleared your fever up. And he was the first one that ever mentioned dysentery. And all them naval doctors were always piles. He never even looked. He said, "that'll be dysentery." They cleared me fever, and they found out it was anemic dysentery. There was several from I was in this ward that got the same. You used to have a stomach wash out every morning with a quart of hot soda water, and then they'd come round and pour a drug in you. that you had to keep in at least half an hour. We managed to say, if you can keep it in longer, all the better. And we kept it in, and after about a month of this, we had a good examination, and we had it all cleared up. I said, right, you've all got to go on convalescent now for a fortnight. I said, no, I don't want to go. I'll go back to the naval barracks. And this army doctor, he said, no, you won't, Ruggles. He said, you'll go with the rest. He said, you're not fit enough to go back to sea yet. You go with the rest. We went to a little seaside port down the east coast of India called Puri, P-U-R-I. They had big floods there a few years ago. And that was like all little bungalow, little chalet, little holiday resort that they'd taken over down there. We had a fortnight down. They said, look, you must play some sport or other every morning. Cricket, football, tennis, hockey, whichever you fancy. But you've got to get fit. So I said, oh, I'll play football. And first morning, I could see the ball coming to me, and I thought, oh, this is easy. Before I knew it, I'd hit my legs and nearly knocked me over. I didn't realise how weak I was. Anyhow, we had a fortnight down, back to Calcutta Hospital, and then back to the naval base. He said, there's a letter here. I'm suggesting to the naval authorities that they give you a month's job, easy job, sure job for a month at least.